definitely a way to counterbalance China's effort.
Japan and India forge closer trade and military ties. It's Tuesday, October 30th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, a passenger jet crashes near Indonesia. Australia takes a tough stance on refugees. Taiwan fires into the South China Sea controversy. Rising tides begins to sink farmers' very hard carrots. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has engaged in big power diplomacy, hosting Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi after a three-day summit in China and meetings with senior officials, including President Xi Jinping. In Beijing, Mr. Abe signed $18 billion in business deals as well as a $30 billion currency swap pact as a way to enhance trade and support financial markets. Yoichiro Saito is a professor of international strategic studies at the Ritsumeikan Asia-Pacific University in Japan. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Japan-India summit, aimed at a free and open Indo-Pacific region, is significant.
For Modi, the visit to Japan is after 2 years since the last time and his third time. And Abe received Modi with utmost reception by taking him to a nice resort town in the central part of Japan. And they had a very productive meeting about reassuring their mutual commitment to the free and open Indo-Pacific, which has become a central keyword for the Abe administration these days.
Can we say this meeting is kind of a counterweight to China?
It's definitely a way to counterbalance China's effort, especially the Maritime Belt Initiative, which China has been conducting in the very same Indo-Pacific region.
It comes just a day after he came back from Beijing with a fairly successful summit there.
Yes, in fact, it's been reported that Abe briefed Modi about his meeting with China. So I guess part of that is to reassure Modi that the Abe's meeting with the Chinese leaders does not mean significant recourse of Japan's strategic orientation.
Interesting that India and Japan are going to hold their first joint military exercises involving ground troops next month.
Yes, this is very significant. The two countries have been engaging themselves in joint maritime exercises for some 10, 11 years. I think the first Japanese participation in the Operation Malabar military naval exercise was in 2007, and Japan has been frequent participant in this exercise. But the ground troop cooperation is new development.
Well, this comes, as I said, on the heels of this rather historic meeting between top Chinese officials and Prime Minister Abe, forging deals totaling $18 billion, also a $30 billion currency swap pact. This is being described as a historic turning point in the relations between these two former enemies, was it?
In Japan, the significance of the bilateral meeting has been somewhat downplayed, and the Japanese government has been busy explaining the currency swap in terms of the interest of Japanese banks in China rather than the interest of China per se.
Are trade tensions involving both countries with the United States driving them together, do you think?
They have announced that they would like to jointly promote free trade. This indeed is a very subtle response to the Trump administration's leaning toward protectionism, but they avoided using the word protectionism because that will really imply the United States as a kind of common problem for them. I think they kind of diluted the language by using the promotion of free trade.
The two countries, once bitter enemies in World War II, reestablished relations in 1972 and are marking 40 years of a friendship treaty. President Xi said bilateral ties have returned to the right track and China will ensure the positive momentum continues. Mr. Abe invited him to visit Japan next year, but the Japanese leader also cautioned there could be no genuine improvement in bilateral ties unless there is stability in the East China Sea. Yoichiro Sato said, unfortunately, even as the two leaders met, another Chinese patrol vessel violated the contiguous waters around the disputed islands known in Japan as Senkaku and in China as Diaoyu. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOANews.com. Japan and India leaders agree to step up defense and economic ties. 21 dead in East China mining accident. U.S. envoy to North Korea expresses confidence about denuclearization. China's yuan sinks to 10-year low against dollar. Fear of deportation drives some Rohingya refugees from India. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our VOANews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We continue with VOA Asia. Indonesian officials say there are likely no survivors after a Lion Air flight with 189 passengers and crew on board crashed into the sea Monday, 13 minutes after taking off from Jakarta. We hear more from AP correspondent Charles de Lidsma.
Lion Air says the jet, on a 1 hour and 10 minute flight from Jakarta to an island close to Sumatra, was carrying 181 passengers, including one child and two babies, and eight crew members. Indonesia's disaster agency has posted photos online of a crushed smartphone, books, bags, and parts of the aircraft fuselage that had been collected by search and rescue vessels. The weather conditions were normal, but the brand new aircraft had experienced a technical issue on its previous flight. The crash is a blow to the country's aviation safety record after the lifting of bans on its airlines by the EU and the US.
AP correspondent Charles de Lidsma. Indonesian search and rescue teams recovered debris including body parts, personal belongings, and parts of the aircraft from what is believed to be the scene of the crash. Officials said that among the passengers were one child and two babies, and Italian pro cyclist Andrea Manfredi, who died in the crash, according to reports in local and Italian media. Several bodies are reported to have been recovered. At a news briefing Monday, Search and Rescue Operation Director Bambang Suryo Aji said they believe most of the crash victims are still in the plane underwater. The Search and Rescue Agency deployed divers in their search for the main wreckage of the plane that crashed north of Java Island. The plane went down in waters about 30 meters to 35 meters deep and about 15 kilometers off the coast. The Lion Air Flight JT610 took to have landed in the capital of Bangka Belitung tin mining region at 7:20 a.m. local time, according to Flight Trader 24 website. The accident is the first reported that involves a Boeing 737 MAX, an updated and widely sold aircraft that is more fuel efficient. The plane maker said on a tweet that it was aware of the accident and was closely monitoring the situation. Happening now in Asia, the leaders of Japan and India agreed Monday to step up their cooperation in defense, trade, and a range of other areas amid China's growing influence in the region. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and his counterpart Narendra Modi said they are expanding high-level defense talks and joint military exercises. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Australia wants to ban refugees that have been detained after arriving by boat and resettled in other countries from ever entering Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports ministers say the measures would stop migrants using the so-called back door into the country.
There's been mounting pressure on Australia's centre-right government to give refuge to more than 50 child migrants held on Nauru. Some have been detained on the tiny South Pacific Republic for 5 years. The island of Nauru is host to an Australian-sponsored detention facility. Doctors have been expressing increasingly grave fears for the children's mental and physical health. The government says it's willing to allow asylum seekers and refugees on Nauru to start new lives in other countries. The United States has an agreement to resettle hundreds of migrants held in Australian offshore processing centres. New Zealand too has offered a home to 150 refugees. There is, though, a condition to Australia's acquiescence. Any migrant resettled in a third country would never be allowed to enter Australia. Canberra argues this would maintain the integrity of a border protection policy that's designed to deter unauthorised boat arrivals. The opposition Labour Party says it will now support the legislation, but only for those refugees being sent to New Zealand from Australia's controversial offshore processing centre on the island of Nauru. Peter Dutton, Australia's Home Affairs Minister, says Labour's approach is flawed.
Let me say this, Mr Speaker. There are 13 children on Nauru at the moment that are involved in family groups. Adults, mostly males within that family unit, are the subject of adverse security assessments from the United States. Now, the first question, Mr Speaker, is New Zealand going to take those people where the United States has advised that that person, that individual in the family unit, is a risk to national security?
Labour's immigration spokesman Shane Newman says the well-being of vulnerable children is his priority.
Labour thinks that we need to prioritise the health and welfare of these children and their families in Nauru, and that's why Labour's been prepared to move its position in this respect.
More than 200 detainees are held in Nauru. Under strict border control laws, Canberra seeks to deny them resettlement in Australia, even if their refugee claims are genuine. Australia argues that offshore processing is a powerful deterrent for migrants risking their lives at sea, often trying to make the journey on rickety fishing boats from Indonesia. Rights groups have consistently claimed conditions are cruel and inhumane. A second offshore centre at Manus Island in Papua New Guinea closed last year after local judges said it was unconstitutional. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, Taiwan again in the line of fire. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, the death toll from a mining accident in East China rose to 21 Monday after rescuers pulled two more bodies from the mine following a nine-day search. State media says the tunnel where 22 miners were working was blocked at both ends by coal after pressure caused rocks to fracture and break October 20th. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Taiwan, normally quiet in the tense six-way South China Sea sovereignty dispute, is likely to raise suspicion among the other claimants with a live fire drill near the sea's biggest natural island. A spokesman said Monday the Taiwanese Coast Guard will conduct routine live fire exercises November 21st through the 23rd around Taiping Island in the Spratly Archipelago. Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense declined to say whether naval units would participate. Because Taiwan normally says little in the broader South China Sea dispute, as it controls just two of about 500 tiny islets and has no formal diplomatic relations with the other five claimants, its activity may cause pushback as other disputants, including China, try to get along better. Oi Sun teaches international studies at Singapore Nanyang University.
I don't really know what is meant by routine here, but if it is some sort of military exercise, I don't think it is routine. That would definitely upset the status quo. Yet to prepare to face the consequences, that means others would also stage similar exercises and there'll be a new round of mutual condemnations and so on.
Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam claim parts of the 3.5 million square kilometer sea that is prized for fisheries and undersea fuel reserves. China and Taiwan claim all of it. China also claims Taiwan, which has been self-ruled since the 1940s. Beijing is currently working with Southeast Asian governments on a code of conduct to head off any mishaps. Taiwan is not a party to the talks because China does not recognize it as a separate country. On the country's news website VN Express International, Vietnam's government denounced the live fire drill plans last week as a serious violation of Vietnamese sovereignty. Taiwan will use 40-millimeter grenade launchers and other weapons during a drill that will cover a radius of 8 kilometers. Vietnam went on to say the drills around Taiping Island threaten peace, stability, maritime safety and security, create tension, and complicate the situation in the South China Sea. The United States does not claim the sea, but periodically sends ships and B-52 bombers in support of its policy that the sea should be open to freedom of navigation. China has irked other countries by installing military infrastructure on some of the islets under its control. Washington sees Taiwan as part of a network of Asian democracies that hope to contain China's expansion, and informal Taiwan-U.S. ties have improved under President Donald Trump. Beijing usually avoids challenging Taiwan's South China Sea activities, but has become increasingly testy toward Tsai's government over two-way issues. Fabrizio Buzzato, a Taiwan Strategy Research Association fellow specialized in Asia and the Pacific, says Taiwan's government may hope to show that President Tsai Ing-wen is committed to defending the South China Sea interests before midterm local elections November 24th.
The exercise convey a message to the other claimants that Taipei is willing and ready to defend its territorial integrity. Also, the exercises are a way to show to the United States and the other powers and to other countries upholding the principle of freedom of navigation in the South China Sea that Taiwan is willing to do its part.
In 2016, Taiwan's Coast Guard and Navy held search and rescue exercises near Taiping Island. A year earlier, Taiwan had positioned itself as a humanitarian player in the maritime sovereignty dispute and urged all countries to share resources. Live fire drills are useful given Taiping's size, says Andrew Young, Secretary General of the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies think tank in Taiwan. He says they are also, quote, routine as protests from Vietnam.
Geographically, the island is so small and actually it's difficult to defend. I think it's a limited show of resolve in terms of defending the island.
Taiwan Defense Ministry spokesman Chen Chengqi said Monday the government sees Taiping as a humanitarian rescue center, but that any military participation in drills next month would be for security purposes. The island, 400 meters wide and 1,400 meters long, has a 10-bed hospital and an airstrip along with a pier. Our thanks go to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. This news from VOA Asia. Indonesian officials say there are likely no survivors after a Lion Air flight with 189 passengers and crew on board crashed into the sea 13 minutes after taking off from Jakarta. Indonesia's search and rescue agency posted online photos of debris, including a crushed smartphone, books, bags, and parts of the aircraft. All the big stories come your way on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, as climate change raises sea levels, salty ocean water is pushing its way inland. That's ruining valuable farmland around the world. On Maryland's eastern shore, once productive fields are succumbing to the saline waters. VOA's Steve Barragona tells us researchers are looking for ways to keep farmers in business as the land changes.
Maryland's eastern shore is home to some of the oldest farms in America. This land has been in Bob Fitzgerald's family since the 17th century. Now, he says, big changes are taking place.
All this, you can see where I planted this with soybeans, and they just died. You know, they died when the water hit them.
Tidal flooding and saltier groundwater are hitting farmers from above and below, and the losses are accelerating with climate change.
You just can't believe how it's taken things over in the last 15 or 20 years. I can show you land around here that people raised tomatoes on when I was a little boy, and now it's gone. And these houses periodically get salt water out.
A short drive from Fitzgerald's home, some neighbors have surrendered their farms as salt water seeps deeper and deeper inland.
Basically, they've had to give up on this whole area because the salt took it over. Now we go down here to this farm. It's already been abandoned and turned into a wildlife area.
Kate Tully is a farm ecologist at the University of Maryland. She hopes to help farmers hold on to their land as the sea encroaches.
So when I realized we had this big issue with saltwater intrusion, it seemed natural to sort of come down, start talking to farmers, and then starting to build out plots like this.
These test plots will help farmers figure out what they can grow as the soil gets saltier. Sorghum is one possibility to help feed the region's $3.4 billion poultry industry.
Sorghum is my new favorite crop because it can grow without rain and it can grow with lots of rain. So this is actually looks like a pretty good option.
But farming the land may not be the best option. Another choice, Tully says, is to surrender to nature.
So you could actually restore the land back to a wetland. And some farmers are doing that because duck hunting is very popular down here. So they're trying to, you know, sort of encourage the waterfowl to come back, and then they can either use the land to hunt or they can lease the hunting rights.
Tully and her colleagues are just starting to figure out what will make the most financial sense to sustain communities that have been farming this land for centuries.
There's a lot of history there, and as these seas rise, some of that history is going underwater. And I just find that to be a pretty motivating reason to try to figure out what we can do for these farmers.
But the clock is ticking.
I'd say in the next 20 years, you're going to lose a very high percentage of that land that's going to be unfit to farm.
It's a fate that coastal farms around the world face as the seas continue to rise. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Princess Anne, Maryland.
It may come as a surprise that cement is responsible for 7% of the world's carbon emissions. That's because it takes a lot of heat to produce the basic powdery base of cement that eventually becomes concrete. But it turns out that a simple fiber from carrots could not only reduce that carbon footprint, but also make concrete stronger. VOA's Kevin Enix has concrete details to share.
The simple carrot is a good source of vitamin A, but this fibrous root vegetable may also be an ally in the fight against climate change. Scientists from Lancaster University, working with a Scottish firm, mashed up a lot of carrots to extract nanoplatelets, linked chains of atoms that are hard to break apart. Adding this carrot extract to cement mixtures makes the resulting concrete a whole lot stronger.
Our preliminary results show that adding about half a kilogram of carrot nanomaterial will reduce about 10 kilograms of cement per one cubic concrete.
The nanoplatelets increase the amount of calcium silicate hydrate in concrete. That's what makes concrete strong. In stress tests, the carrot concrete performed extremely well.
Makes the concrete more stronger. We found out that you could increase the strength by 80% by using a small amount of this new material.
That's not all the team at Lancaster University came up with. In a separate study, the team created another kind of cement that adds highly conductive potassium to the mixture. Add a few bronze wires and these little blocks become little concrete batteries. By connecting them to solar panels, bridges could hold a charge long enough to power their own lights at night and monitor their own structural health.
In addition to storing energy, these batteries could be used as self-sensors. Essentially, you can embed them into a structure like a bridge or a wind turbine to detect the cracks produced, you know, by winds or heavy traffic in a bridge.
That's a huge and exciting idea. But what these researchers have discovered could greatly reduce the carbon footprint of cement, and that could have a concrete impact in the fight against global warming. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can hear us on the radio, Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in today. And we send our thanks out to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.